This is Nash with Radio Dead Air. I am speaking with Trace Beaulieu. I got it right, correct?
Yes, absolutely right.
From MST3K fame, thank you for giving us some time today. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for grabbing me. I was just walking through the hall, and I just was in a daze. And you knew who I was, and I didn't, so.
I could not know. Not. I'm too many negatives there, I think. Anyway, Trace, you were very early on with MST3K. Why don't you give people who have not seen it, which I don't know who on the planet hasn't seen it, but a little bit of a rundown how you came into it and how things got started for you.
Mystery Science Theater started with Joel Hodgson. It was his idea, and we were pals. We knew each other from stand-up in Minneapolis, and we'd hang out. We actually were in a writing group that we would meet in the library, the public library in the morning. And he and Josh Weinstein and I all were hanging out, and Joel said, "Hey, I got this idea. I'm working on this crazy kind of weird puppet show thing. Come on over to the station, and we're going to make a show." And it was that easy. We walked over, grabbed a puppet off the floor. He said, "Go grab one of those puppets," and there were piles of plastic laying on the floor. And I grabbed Crow, and Josh grabbed what would become Tom Servo. It was Beeper at the time. And we started working on Mystery Science Theater. And the first episode, we were just in the theater. We weren't really saying too much. And as it evolved, out of desperation to get some kind of response, we started barking back to the movie. And that's kind of the origins. And over the next 22 shows, we kind of evolved the mythology and of the mad scientists. We brought them in. And that's in a nutshell how Mystery Science started. And that was 20-some years ago. So we're going into our, I don't know what anniversary this is, if it's paper or, it's probably hot glue. We're in our spray paint toxins and hot glue anniversary.
I was about to ask about that. You everything on that set, you didn't send out for anything to be made. You just got it together and slapped things together, and there were your props. Did everyone participate in that, or?
Joel and I primarily were the builders in the early days. Joel initially pulled an all-nighter and built the KTMA set.
In a night,
and all the robots. So they were really, he had, cored out the essentials of the bot shapes in a night. I remember going over to his house, and he had the set laid out on his driveway. And this is all toys and plastic parts that he'd culled from Goodwill and Salvation Army and thrift stores. And he'd built props and robots prior to this, so he had, he had the hot glue thing down.
The writing early on, all through it, was this a group effort, or was it just, someone would come in and say, "Hey, here's what we're going to do," or you'd sit down and you'd just see what came out, and that's how did the writing sessions go?
Initially, there was no writing. It was all improvisation. We might write the sketches, the interstitials for the host segments that we called them. But those were, I would say they're barely written. Maybe spend a good 15, 20 minutes on all of the sketches for the day. And then we'd get into the theater, and we would see the movie for the first time. This is in the early KTMA days. And we would literally sit like 2 feet off of a wall that was painted blue so we could do our theater seat effect. And we would see the movie unspool before us for the first time, and we would comment on it. And out of, like I said, desperation for some response, we would start filling holes with jokes. And that's kind of how the riffing started. And then Joel took the best of 22 two-hour episodes and culled those down into a really tight, good 7-minute cell tape. And he had a relationship with I think it was Comedy Channel at that time.
Comedy Channel and Ha.
Yeah, they merged. Yeah, worlds collided, and CPO Sharky couldn't fill the entire programming schedule. So they saw our show as something really cheap and funny, and we filled 2 hours of programming time on a channel that was just starting out, and they gave us a great opportunity to launch. The channel was really instrumental in our success in that we got out to a larger audience. We were now on cable. Cable was kind of new, and we had a lot of freedom. Doing the show in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, we were left alone. You know, people would look on a map and go, I don't even know where Minnesota is. Where's Eden Prairie? Prairie? What do you guys got, like cabins and, you know, sod homes? Or you?
They're thinking Garrison Keillor. And...
Yeah, exactly. So no one wanted to come and visit us, let alone give us notes. So, but the 7-minute cell tape really showed us that if you have more than one joke a minute, it's a much more enjoyable experience for the audience. So it became more rapid-fire joke. And then we hired real writers. I mean, not that we weren't writers, but, you know, we augmented our staff with more people that could all contribute. And then we'd sit in a room, writing room, and we'd that was the best day of the week because we'd watch these movies and we would just try to make each other laugh. And everything went into the script. And then Frank or Mary Jo later on would take the take all the jokes and cull them down and then start assigning the lines and throwing out jokes that didn't work. Often we'd have like 5 jokes for a spot, and then they had the luxury of picking which was the best one, or maybe the dire task of, you know, what's the only one that'll fill this hole, you know?
Time-wise, yeah.
Was there ever anything during those sessions that just everybody said, this is hysterical, but there's no way we can put this on the air?
You know, I don't think we ever said we can't put this on the air. That was really someone else's decision. We just said, we're having a good time. I hope it translates, you know, to the audience. And it did. I mean, if we were making 7 people in a room laugh, well, at least there's 7 people that would watch the show.
Speaking of that, what was your reaction after the cancellation and then everyone, it all exploded to get you back? How did it feel to know you had the fandoms were so insane for the show?
Yeah, well, it's still evolving. I mean, 20 years on and there are new fans who have only seen it on DVD. Or, you know, we see people who are now in their adulthood who said, I grew up watching your show. And that's like, it's kind of mind-blowing because we grew up watching shows that we really admired, and we never thought we'd be making a show that would, you know, get out of the electronic range of Eden Prairie, let alone, you know, we've got fans all over the world now. And now with our new venture, Cinematic Titanic, which is Joel, John,
we saw the screening.
Right, Frank and Mary Jo. Mm-hmm. We've got fans all over the world. We just sold, for some reason, Norway is a big, I don't know why we appeal to the Nords, but yeah, it's gone global, and it's just amazing.
Trace, thank you for giving us some time today. I appreciate, and Cinematic Titanic is the current project. Do you have anything else upcoming that we should keep an eye out for?
CinematicTitanic.com has taken all our time, so we are, we're all scattered around the country, but we are working in a virtual writing room now.
CinematicTitanic.com. Trace, thank you for giving me some time. This has been Nashville Radio at Air. I have been speaking with Trace. And oh, my God. Did I just forget how to say your name?
It's like you're bowling.
Trace Beaulieu.
You're bowling. You bowl.
Beaulieu. Trace Beaulieu. See, why do they let me do this? Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, man. It's been great.
This is Radio Dead Air.